When I was a girl, I was told by another little girl that I could not read, that I would never read. It was far above my station to even hope for literacy. And you want to know a secret? I was angry.
Welcome back to I Leave You Love, the life and times of Mary McLeod Bethune. My name is Amanda Huxtable, and this is episode 2. I'm a digital storyteller in both theatre and screen, and have been for several years. I tell stories with fellow creatives that place advocacy, activism, and social justice at the core of our work. This podcast is about a remarkable woman, someone who really made a difference, who you may not be aware of. A black female who changed history as an activist and educator for black women's rights in the USA and across the world. Mary McLeod Bethune. I'm here with writer and academic Anita Franklin and writer and artist Desiree Reynolds. If you'd like to hear part one, you can listen to it on vanitasarts.co.uk. In the last episode, we looked at fear. In this episode, we continue to explore fear and how this impacted upon Mary McLeod Bethune. Please note, our podcast includes some material and discussions on racial threats and domestic violence. Advisory for minimum age 13 plus, or at your own discretion.
There were plenty who would say to me, "That's enough now, Mary Jane. That's enough, Miss Mary. That's enough, Mrs. Bethune." Oh, there's nothing so pitiful as men scared of a strong woman, or women worried that some woman is out to capture the affections of their man. I consider these small matters in the scheme of things. So when I heard no, I would just go elsewhere until I found a yes.
We just heard Mary tell us when she heard no, she would go elsewhere until she found a yes.
Yes, we told Truman what to do. And you know what? He did it. Well, most of it. The federal protections against lynching still aren't there. The Yankees, more scared of the Klan and their friends in high places than we are. Imagine that. These folks, they can hold back the whole country if you let them. I'm not gonna let them hold me back. Are you? Are we? I'm helpless without your fellowship and cooperation. And so are you.
There are some people that I wish I could have had a drink with, and Zora Neale Hurston is one of those people.
You may leave and go to Halifax, but my slow drag is gonna bring you back. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back. I've been in the country, but I moved to town. I'm a total shaker from the head on down. Well, you may go.
Best known today for her novel Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is taught in high schools and colleges throughout the US.
It's a doggone lie. I'm a backbone breaker. Well, you may go.
In 1933, still at the cusp of her career, the flamboyant Hurston came to Daytona Beach for the first time with high hopes, because as she wrote her friend in her letter,
"Dear Cicely, can you believe it? Mary McLeod Bethune, president of Bethune-Cookman College, has invited me to her 57th birthday celebration. Mrs. Bethune has also invited me to establish a school of dramatic arts based on pure Negro expression. And I wish to work out themes for the drama school that will be gorgeously Negro. Your undying friend, Zora."
I'm glad you mentioned Zora. Because it'd be good to pick up on what she said, what we heard. I think for me, Zora is a woman that I would have loved to have met, no doubt. I mean, I think it's something about the way she wore a hat that I'm pretty impressed with.
Yeah.
She has this fierceness that you delivered, that energy that just seems to fire through.
We have to thank Alice Walker, not only for Alice Walker's own work, but for the fact of rediscovering Zora Neale Hurston. Zora Neale Hurston, during her heyday in the United States, her books and what have you, were very popular. You know, she was quite a popular person. People were interested in Negro folk culture and that kind of thing. The thing about Zora as well is that her rather glamorous individualist kind of feminism is it's quite easy to do, because we are in that era right now. Yeah. You know, she would love, for instance, Beyonce. And you know, Beyonce kind of decked out in all these kind of different things, and with the Lion King business. She'd also be interested in the fact that the Lion King is actually a story from West Africa, and it is the epic of Sunjata. And she'd just really rub that in. She'd be really into all of that. She'd enjoy it immensely. Zora is younger than Mary McLeod Bethune. But one of the things that I love is that history is just so interesting, because they did know each other. And Zora did work for a short period of time at Bethune-Cookman College. And you just kind of go, that is so amazing, because they do complement each other. And they tell us, for both of them, they both led unconventional lives, and they both have left their mark on African-American culture and on American culture. Don't get. Negro soldiers fought in the Great War and came home, only for too many of them to be strung up for being in a damn uniform. You know, some folks grinning their heads off at Negroes dying for somebody else's democracy, when we barely allowed to even live in peace. There's something about freedom and having the spaces for us to be free, to tell our own stories, live our own truths with no apology. My dear Mary, people aren't ready for us. But we have to keep on marching to what you call it, glory. But I want mine now. How about you, Mary? Ain't you worked hard and long enough for the promised land? When's it coming to us? Or do we have to die first?
Mary found strength, support, and friendship from those who were closer to her, and they were not always in agreement with her ideas, but respected her nevertheless.
I think that now is an interesting time for her spirit to be with us. One of the things that's happening is there is a new statue of Mary McLeod Bethune that has been carved by Nilda Comas. And this was, you know, a huge commission. A lot of international artists went for this commission. Ms. Comas won it and has been creating a life-size statue of Mary McLeod Bethune in Italy.
Oh, lovely.
From some of the last remaining marble that Michelangelo had been using, you know, the source, that particular quarry. So that's kind of interesting. It's an extraordinary moment, and all we can do is just hope that it will actually come to pass. It's something that was supposed to come to pass. But of course, everything in the United States right now that relates to race and black people and Hispanic people and all of this, a lot of it is just can feel quite unstable at the moment. And a lot of this depends on what Governor DeSantis will allow. But you know what? Mary McLeod Bethune would recognize that because she has, throughout her life, she has been a woman who, through organization, has been involved in challenging these kinds of governors and senators and what have you all her life. So she was always busy doing that. So
she's busy doing it now.
She's busy doing it now.
That's a fantastic conversation people are having to have right now. That's exactly the conversations we need to be, rather than kind of sticking to what we've had. Actually, let's regroup, rethink about who we want to represent us in the future. I think it's really exciting, this moment now.
So she is someone who managed to live long, if you see what I mean. And and that's terrific, because sometimes there's a tendency to kind of moan and cry and be really kind of sad, because sometimes, you know, our leaders are taken from us early on. And you know, there's a kind of poignancy and what have you around that. But it's important to understand that we also have people who've done a lot of work who, guess what? They died in their bed.
Yes.
You know,
they lived well.
They lived well and they died in their bed. You do not have to, you know, be some kind of, I don't know, sacrificial victim in order to.
Doesn't have to be part of the plan.
Yes. He'd heard it would take an hour to cross the water. In the dark, it looked endless, even if the moon shone glowing and accusing. it was him or me. He could feel his blood oozing from a dozen wounds. He ignored the cold, the pain in his side, his own stench, alligators snoring in the mangroves. He ignored the tricks the water played on him, wavelets masquerading as arms, legs, weeds at his feet tangling round his ankles, making him think about the shackles he just escaped. He shook in shock and in fear. He thought, there's no way out or back. The cold black water tugged at his feet, knees, belly, pulling him further in and deeper. His teeth chattered. The stars winked at him. It was you or him, they seemed to say. He heard the dogs and horses in the distance, stretched out his arms and held his breath. He dipped beneath the surface into the inky depths and moved clumsily with no experience nor skill to the other side. If you sit and think on these things, you'll see that burning times, lynching times, they peak at election times. The greatest danger I ever felt was when women got the vote, and the Ku Klux Klan feared how Negro women would vote in the 1923 election. I campaigned for women to get the vote, and I helped register Negro women all over Florida. So it was inevitable the Klan would come and threaten me and my school.
I'd seen pictures. I'd glanced and seen this incredible stateswoman, you know, stateswoman-like woman, but I hadn't really clocked her story at all. And when you started to unravel, and I asked you the question, so if you were on any American, you know, street, and you passed a few people and asked them about Mary, how many people would know? You know, so obviously in Florida, absolutely no, because she's, you know, she, you know, she belongs to them. And it, because if you have it in here, in the UK, very few.
Very few, yes. Very few. It's much more the case that, you know, if you're listening to some of our public intellectuals, someone like Henry Louis Gates, of course, you know, he will probably have a podcast somewhere that, you know, that we haven't seen. Again, you know, someone like Morgan Freeman, who runs various programs and what have you now. All of these people will know. Certainly, again, Alice Walker, you know, these people will know of Mary McLeod Bethune, but she's not in our public consciousness in the way that other people are. And yet, it is the case that a lot of what we take for granted in the U.S. right now, she was a part of.
Time, weather, and...
And now, a speech addressing the nation from Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune.
Today, all of us are living in even graver days than were those when the words that I just read were written
I said then and I say now, we need to strengthen our democratic principles and to apply them more forthrightly and effectively. For this task, we need the aid and loyalty of all citizens devoted to their country and the good for which it stands. We cannot instill loyalty into the hearts of men by coercion and fear. Loyalty is a child of the spirit and not a child of fear.
As a child, I had to entertain a little white girl while my mother worked for her family. Cleaning, cooking, canning tomatoes, peaches, and oh yes, figs. The little girl was called Camille, and I remember one time when she wanted to jump rope. "Here, let's play jump rope, Mary." And I said, "Okay." Just about to get up when she said, "No, let's do something else." And I said, "But I want to skip rope." She pouted her little lips and threatening a tantrum. "No," she said, and snatched the rope away. I try again. "I know. Let's play ball." I had a little ball in my pocket, and I took it out and gave it to her. "Ow! You know she hit me with that ball I give her." I shouted in surprise, "Why did you want to hit me so hard with the ball, Camille?" I studied her squeezing drops from out of her eyes. "It's all right, Camille. It's all right. It doesn't hurt that much." And she said, "You my friend, Mary." I give way and said, "I'm your friend, Camille." She was still pouting and ask me, "Promise?" So I sighed, "Promise."
There's a collective sigh after hearing that in the room. And I just want to begin opening that up with Camille. How many Camilles have you come across in your life?
Ooh, Jesus.
Oh my God. Oh. So many.
They call them Karen now.
That promise at the end, it really sticks here in my throat.
Mm-hmm.
It's the promise that we keep making in trying to work out some sort of alliance with white womanhood. Mm-hmm. And that's what that is. You know, as I have written Mary is someone who remains committed to working with women, black, white, Asian women, you know, one, the first female Indian diplomat, you know, she met with, and they had a grand time together. She was very interested in trying to work with women. She recognized that there is a common bond there. And so for me, this little story is about that that kind of difficult friendship. Sometimes it's not a friendship. Sometimes it's something else. But that nevertheless, there is an inbuilt promise of some kind that we are bound to. I know, it just makes you like sad. I know.
It's proper deep, and I didn't feel like it was friendship. I felt it was oppressive, and I wondered whether if Mary at that time might have been even a little bit older than Camille.
She was a little bit older.
And that too is something that deference to whiteness, where whiteness rules all. And what I take heart in, I guess, because there's just too many white women white womaning. But what I like about now is that we now have language for it.
Oh, yes.
Right? Yeah. So we now have
didn't we? But now we can drop it and everyone knows what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, I think
I know what you mean, though. The white women tears thing is
the white women tears, yeah, where we can where we can say Emmett Till died because of white women's tears. And we all know what that means. So I think there's a change that's happened. Like I say, I always say these things that there's just changes, and it's for history to find out whether they stick or not. But the idea of now white womanhood having to examine itself, and it's like even stuff with Trump and having to examine its role in his rise to power, even though they are you know, what he did to them didn't seem to matter when it came to when it came to voting. But I'm liking where we're at now. Well, we can talk about white women's tears, and we can talk about how dangerous they are. And I think Camille literally is an embodiment of that.
And Camille comes from me looking at various photos during the, basically after Reconstruction. So we're talking about in the early 1900s, where there was a lot of lynching. People would bring their Camilles onto site to watch lynchings. As kind of like entertainment.
Beer baiting.
So all of that sits inside of Camille. Camille, although she is small, she has learned a number of things.
Exactly. Yeah. But even if it's not something as huge as lynching, as spectacle as lynching, even it's about the fact that Camille could boss her mum around in the home, because it's her mum that is a domestic worker.
Yes.
And Camille could say to her mum, what are you doing? That, you know, where Mary couldn't talk to her mum like that, Camille probably could.
Yeah. Yes, and all of that applied whether you were in the house or on the street. And in other words, this is what, any white child could look to any African-American adult and tell them what to do. Again, it's the whole business of interfering.
Code of conduct of being.
Yeah, right. Just constant interference, surveillance. You're here policing to serve me. Yes.
I was just wanting to pick up on, you know, the two girls. One gets hurt. The vulnerability of black femalehood never gets recognized. I think that's something I'm really excited about. If that's, we're okay, we can cry now. I don't know if anyone's going to actually care, but we can at least reveal that we do cry and hurt. And if someone, you know, that this kind of the black body was incredibly all powerful, but also weak. It's very confusing, isn't it? Which one are we?
Well, and you see, the thing is, I still sometimes wonder to what extent little black girls are allowed their innocence.
Yeah.
Mm. stay there. Keep the door shut. Go in now. Claire, get them children in. Get them inside. Don't even come out. Claire, don't you dare bring anybody out until I say so. Okay? Stay inside.
You know, it's like when some of the darkest days, and you're like, you're watching the news again, and you can't believe what's happening. You know, there's for me, it feels to me over this last period, the gift of music, the gift of the lyrics, what has been said, you know, to remind us of who we are on humanity, has really kind of saved me.
She was a woman of tremendous faith. I don't know of anybody who. Still, who's able to embody that. I mean, I know people who are very religious, but she wasn't religious in that kind of way. She was of faith, which seems to me to be without, that is without a denomination. You know what I mean? It's raw. It's like
spirit.
It is. It's spirit. Mm. It's spirit. And so I think that that is one of the things she... You know, in some of the stuff that I've read about her, she tells a story of her mother giving her a copy of the New Testament before she could even read. She put this small copy of the New Testament in her hand, and that in some sense, she still, as an old woman, remembered the feel of this New Testament in her hand. She, at the time, she couldn't read it, but in some sense, it connected her to something around faith. She also, and this is very important again, she also knew herself to be loved. Mm-hmm. Her parents loved each other, and they had 17 kids.
They did. Mm-hmm. She was 16 for the 17.
And she was like 16, mm-hmm. but she still felt loved and welcomed and special. And she said that was a really important thing for her and for anyone, that whole thing of knowing that you were loved and you were wanted in the world,
it's powerful.
It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. And it made me sit up and think and really understand how hard it is for some people. Because they don't have that sense of certainty that they were wanted and loved and that, yes, I am supposed to be here. I am special. Mm-hmm. She had that and she recognized it as a privilege. She recognized that not other people necessarily had that.
I imagine she gave that as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
For those who didn't have that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that she... knew that that's what those people, the children that she worked with, needed that before anything else, probably.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it, for her, teaching was one of these things that came to her because she loved learning. She couldn't help but become a teacher because she loved learning so much. And then what would happen was in learning about things and then being able to share it, mm-hmm. she would understand the learning even more.
Well, you come from education. Your background is, I'm sitting next to a real life Mary in front of me. And that's something that you carry with you very powerfully. And I think that one of the things about what she had, the faith that you talk about is also the faith in humanity. I think that's what she has in her interaction with the shooter. That's what you feel like. She has faith in humanity. And whilst Anita and I every now and then connect to go, what is going on? Anita too also carries a huge amount of faith with humanity and shares that regularly whenever she can, don't you?
Keeps us going.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I have to say that, you know, writing this is, for me, a kind of a full circle thing, because when I was a child coming up, my mother would tell me about Mary McLeod Bethune. And Mary McLeod Bethune, you had to call all her name, you know. You couldn't just call her Mary. Or, you know? Yeah. And so she was one of these people who was, I hate the word icon because it's so abused now. Mm. You know, people are around for 5 minutes. Oh, they're an icon. Mm. But she was someone who my mother would point to as not only important for what she contributed to the community, but it was also beyond that. It was something about her character. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day, people talked about something mm-hmm. called character. Mm-hmm. And that is what one of the things that I remember as a child, mm-hmm. just the whole business of making sure that you kind of conducted yourself in a way that, in some sense, that Mary McLeod Bethune would approve that you. It's the business about, you know, certain kind of integrity and a certain kind of perseverance, you know. So these are the kinds of words and virtues that were important, and my mother was, in some sense, passing on to me. Well, you know, Mary McLeod Bethune was the kind of person who did this, and she would not have done that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting that these things, sometimes we forget things, sometimes history is forgotten, mm-hmm. but sometimes if we just scratch beneath the surface, mm-hmm. we can actually find it. Because, yeah, people don't talk about Mary McLeod Bethune in the way that today we talk about Zora Neale Hurston.
Talking about what Mary was talking about, which was, it feels to me like she was between a rock and a hard place, and that is not just facing racism, but dealing with a fear of her own people. So there are a lot of people who said no. Mm. You know, there was a point where Mary was heard to say, you know, no, Mary Jane, no, Mrs. Bethune, mm-hmm. just no. But she found her yes. I just want to talk a bit more about that and just mm-hmm. how people find their yeses with all that facing of discouragement and all the reasons why people choose not to do something.
Oh my goodness. Because of course we hear a lot of no today, don't we, Desiree? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just, do you mean yeses? Because you were talking about her saying, finding the no's within her own community. Is that what you mean? The mm-hmm. no's that we all face within our own community.
Yeah, I'm just going to paint it out. So,
yeah,
you know, like you reminded us 10 years after Slave, you know, this is a very, very volatile moment. You're just lucky to be out and free. You know, parents are just trying to get down and get look after their children. And she all she wants to do is read, and that's actually was illegal only how many before that. Not only that, but she wants to actually open that up to everybody else as well and build a school. And can you imagine her neighbourhood like, you're going too far. You're just, this is too far. Something that Vanitas Arts we understand about going too far, but you know, it's so with all that in mind, and all the reasons why you should be afraid, she still did it. We know we talked about courage and all those things, but it's just, how does that happen? How do you pick up and get it done anyway?
I think it goes back to what Anita was saying about her feeling loved and that massive grounding that she had as a child that took her through into her old age. Is there's a strength in being loved that you can take from that and move through your day. Reflecting on myself or the fact that I lived in a particular area.
I'm gonna pick up on, I hear you, with love and action.
Yes.
Because Desiree, you know, you get things done. There are a few things you've been doing recently that didn't get done just because of love. I know that, you know, I hear you, love is good. But in order to create and do what you're doing,
yes,
you have to kind of pick up the phone and make it happen, right?
I see what you're saying. Yeah. I think for me anyway, one of the things that drives me, and it kind of ties into all kinds of different things that you're talking about. I'm sort of here going, there's so much interesting stuff going on here. I suppose one of the things that motivates me, you know, when you talked about music and how grounding that is for both of you, and you thought about when you were writing what might Mary be listening to. And music for me is actually really difficult. I live in a house with two autistic people. Both of my children are autistic. So, and I am a DJ. I was a DJ. I was a very poor singer. Very, very, very poor singer. And I had to change how I felt about music for my kids' sake. I couldn't just blare out my tunes when I needed to, because it was different for them. So we had to change what what influences me. Like, music was part of my childhood, absolutely, with my parents.
I've enjoyed your sets,
And my mum at the gram, you know, and her rice and peas music she always had music on when she was cooking. And she's got a massive collection. She used to work for Decca Records. Anyway, it's another podcast. Just thinking about music, I was thinking, wow, yeah, what's that grounding for me? Well, music for me is completely different now, because my kids and what they needed came first, which then goes back to, why do you do things? For me, it's because I'm trying to make sure that whatever happens, that I leave something that my kids can benefit from, in whatever shape or form that happens. And I think Mary McLeod-Bethune would have been the same way.
So I'm just thinking about my own kind of experiences. That's exactly what I was trying to pick up on. That's because I know action has happened in this table. So I just wanted to kind of pull that out a little. So we bring education at the centre of the conversation. I was raised in London, as yourself. And I remember there was a conversation about supplementary school. We lived in the southeast London. There was one that was in Deptford in the library, and it was there for children who needed the extra help. We know now why that was.
Yes.
You know, I think there's Steve McQueen's doing a couple of episodes and conversations about what we already knew. I know you've been part of that conversation, Anita, for a long time. So the action that was taken, just let's talk a little bit about what action was taken to make that happen and why. You know, if we're talking about education and organisations and individuals,
yes,
then we got our influence from Mary. But, you know, in the UK, when did that happen? How did that happen?
Exactly. I just think that, you know, again, one of the things is there will be people who, for whatever reason, they don't have the time, they don't have the energy, they don't have the confidence to do things like set up a supplementary Saturday school. So what you have to do is you just have to say, oh, that's okay, Olivia. Once the school is set up, I'll let you know. And then you put the phone down, then you pick up the next, you know, you're ringing up Teresa. Well, you know, Teresa, I know you... been in a state over your son's grades.
And now we got WhatsApp. We could do it even quicker.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Make it happen.
I know. And this is what she was good at. She was good. Mary McLeod Bethune was good at, you know, she could hear all of these people saying no, and people saying, oh, but, you know, they're frightened, or, oh, but I'm too busy, or, oh, but, you know, I don't have the confidence. All of that. She could hear that, and she could feel it and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But she kept getting up. She kept getting up. Mm. And I think that that is something that we've got to think about this, because we live in such an individualized world now. Now, see, back in the day, the world was not as individualized as it is today. Even in 1984, when I came to Britain, and, you know, I was like, you know, in a flat somewhere, and people knew that I was, you know, someone who was, you know, a post grad and blah and blah. There would still be little people, you know, knock, knock, knock on my door. Could you help my mother with X and Y?
Yeah.
I hear that you are, you know, an academic. Or, and it was the same thing. Like when you live, you know, when I was living in Sheffield, and there would be knock, knock, knock.
Yeah.
But people now are so individualized. Everything is, you know, you stand or fall on your own individual stuff.
But it takes a kind of energy, doesn't it? Sorry, Desiree, you want to come in?
I was going to agree and disagree all at the same time. I think that actually, like, you know, for me and myself, like, I've been an advocate for young people with disabilities. So my neighbours will come and say, can you write me this letter for this school? Or can you come with me to meet a head teacher? Or can you... And I've done that, and it's there is something that's different that's happening. So whilst I agree with the whole idea of individual versus collective, I also think that now some people, not all people, but some young people are discovering collective action.
Okay.
We would not have what we have now when we're thinking about, I know, Extinction Rebellion, perhaps. I mean, even though it's problematic as hell, and we know Extinction Rebellion needs to buck up its race ideas, but at least they are committing to collective action. So I can, and I see that happening.
Yes.
So whilst I'm agreeing with that, I'm like, you know, come on. But there's a change, I think, and I don't know if it's permanent. I wouldn't commit to saying that we're in different times. I don't necessarily believe that. But I do believe that some people are now acknowledging that collective action is the only way that we can try and support change if we want to move in a transformative way.
If we want a systemic change to the system, or if we want a different system.
Mm.
But sometimes what people want is to simply be comfortable in this system, and in this system, everything is about competitiveness. It's about really drinking in a narrative of me, myself, and I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the same time, you're absolutely right. I can certainly see that we have a lot of collective tools now, and maybe there is some more energy that's going to push people into collective action.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed episode 2 of I Leave You Love, The Life and Times of Mary McLeod Bethune. We hope you can join us for episode 3. This podcast is brought to you by Vanitas Arts. You can find out more about us and the stories we tell at vanitasarts.co.uk and on Twitter at VanitasArts1. Look out for the digital broadcast of I Bring You Love, written by Anita Franklin. I Leave You Love is a 4-episode podcast telling the story of Mary McLeod Bethune, her life and her achievements. Please share your thoughts by sending an email to info@vanitasarts.co.uk.